spiritual meditation is a particular kind of meditation. It means thinking without thinking. That's a very Zen kind of a way to put it. But it means that we let go of the process of thinking, like the musician lets go of the process of playing the music. And we sit for 15 minutes and let go of the control of thinking in meditation. And we arrive at the same state that we arrive at this state of not being the doer maybe two or three times in a half an hour or 20 minutes. And what would be, what do you think the result would be of having this state of real, of stillness, inner stillness, with the eye, not the imaginary eye, not being in control? If we could have that five times, twice a day, how many years would it take take us to be thoroughly unhypnotized anymore and to wake up? The actual struggle is to keep the delusion from falling apart. I think that the struggling and the difficulty, the reason things are difficult, is because not only are we doing it, but then we're ascribing the doing of whatever it is we're doing to this imaginary character who's inside, and we say that this I who then does it. There was an interesting experiment done in 1985, and there have been others too. And you might want to look this up, because if you don't believe me, you can maybe believe some scientific data. A guy named Benjamin LeBay in 85 did some experiments where he hooked people up to EEG machines, reading brainwaves. And he had them perform spontaneous action. Or I can make it very simple, mechanical. You have a box and you've got a green light or a red light. And when the green light comes on, you're supposed to push a button and turn on the red light or turn the green light off, whatever. So he hooked these people up and he had them do it. And the light would come on. This is not the experiment, but you get the idea. The light would come on. They would see it. They would decide to push the button. They push the button and the light goes out. And after a while, the EEG could tell when they had decided to push the button to turn the light off. So then they have the EEG machine turn the light off when they have made the decision to push the button. It turns out that the brain, the mind, decided to push the button about a third of a second before the person was aware that they had the desire to push the button. So there's this third of a second there where the brain has said, perform this action. And then the ego, the I, the imaginary doer, realizes that, or that the brain has the imaginary doer decide to do it. It spooked people out. The feeling was that this machine is reading their mind because it knew what they were going to do before they knew they were going to do it. Well, there's a disconnect there. That this imaginary I is a third of a second late. The action has already been done. The thought has already occurred. The doing has already happened. But a third of a second later, the imaginary I thinks that it, you know, there's this thought that the imaginary I has did it. Well, there's a lot of energy wasted in that, and a lot of time lost, and it makes everything a struggle, because not only do I have to do it, but then I have to attribute it to this imaginary I inside there. So you look, to me, that's a very fascinating thing. It's obviously almost scientific proof that the I is imaginary. So how do we wake up from this delusion? Well, first of all, we have to be searching for the truth again. If we're not searching for the truth, we're going to be just switching delusions or perfecting a delusion. I mean, most people, the problem with enlightenment and self-realization is that most people are not letting go of the I. They're trying to perfect it. They're trying, like my friend, he wanted to be better. I want to become a better person. Sounds good, but becoming a better person will not get you to enlightenment. Doing good works will not get you to enlightenment. Going on pilgrimages and going to meetings like a TAT meeting and going all over the world and visiting enlightened people will not get you to enlightenment. The only thing that works is waking up from the delusion. I was in a coffee house a couple of weeks earlier while I was putting this talk together, and I heard some young people talking, and they were talking about deep stuff. And the one was saying, well, I see a difference between religion and spirituality. To me, spirituality is more about how you grow and better yourself. And the other one said, well, you know, life isn't about finding yourself. It's about creating yourself. Heavy stuff. It sounds really good. And they were reinforcing each other in their idea that they were going to perfect this themselves, their imaginary self, by the way, because the real self is already perfect. You don't need to perfect the omnipresent absolute. So they're busy hypnotizing each other and perpetuating the delusion. I heard another guy. This was amazing. I heard another guy at another table. He was talking. He was explaining to his friends why he was going to get another tattoo. And he had some drawings. He had drawn the ideal tattoo. It really expressed him just to perfection. And he was saying, and he actually said, I want to personalize my body. Yeah, I thought that's... They talked about delusion. He's going to personalize his body.
Sharing with other entities.
Yeah. So still, even with an earnest desire to know the underlying reality and a relentless search for truth, they're essential, but they're evidently not sufficient. Because if you look at science, many generations of scientists and philosophers have been searching for the ultimate universal truth. And they have, especially the scientists, well, the philosophers too. I mean, most of the spiritual literature is full of people who have found the absolute ultimate reality. But the scientists that I've read, although they've come to really similar understandings as the Buddhists and the Vedantins, I mean, the physicists will tell you that there's no substance to the universe. If you look at it, it's just waves in space. And that the space is really the real substance. So they understand that, and they understand the ultimate universal reality, but they don't identify with it, and they don't realize it as being the truth. It's just this interesting scientific understanding. They continue to identify themselves as something separate, and that the universe, although it doesn't really exist, it's really out there, and I'm really in here. And so understanding is not the same as realization. The thing that tips the balance is this surrendering. And it's letting go of the imaginary I. It's letting go of being the doer of action and the thinker of thinking and the feeler of feelings. And practicing this non-volitional thinking gives the reinforcing of the delusion a rest. We sit down and meditate and let go of all control of the meditation. You have a technique to perform, to do. I'm going to sit down, I'm going to meditate, and this is the technique I'm supposed to do. And then you don't do it. This letting go of control, we begin to experience deeper levels of awareness in the meditation. And the actual thinker of the thought becomes a little closer. That gap of a third of a second between the time we think that we thought it and the time that it actually was thought gets a little smaller. And there is, even though we don't overtly experience that we're experiencing subtle levels of thinking or truer levels of thinking, it has an effect. It is an anti-delusional. It cuts through the fog of hypnotic suggestion and gives us a brief experience of the inner reality. So practice of surrender, practice of non-doing, is the second anti-delusional besides just the intellectual search for truth. And the third thing that is really good anti-delusional is self-inquiry. And these, it's actually asking, well, what am I? What about my personality? What do I really think and feel? What am I telling myself constantly every day? What are my recurrent thought processes? And getting together with other people in self-inquiry, confronting each other, but not to confront each other. Self-confrontation with other people is very helpful too. So searching for truth, practice non-doing on a regular basis, and join a group and do self-inquiry. Really look at the personality, this imaginary. You know, if you get the idea that the personality is really just a construct, an imaginary thing, then if you look at it, it begins to dissolve, it begins to fall apart. You begin to see that it's just something that you made up. Self-inquiry, looking at our life, our whole life history, remembering what happened to us as children and how that affected us and what we decided at that time. You begin to realize that the personality was a defense against what appeared to be a hostile world. And that usually our personality was something that we invented as children and kept adding on to. People in high school especially are all about fixing them, creating a great personality, like this person in the coffee house. You know, life is about creating yourself. Well, that's inventing the imaginary character that we think that we need to be. So I'm going to talk for the most part about the search for truth. I assume everybody's here because we're already searching for the truth and we're looking for it. And I'm not going to focus on the self-inquiry part today, but I found a lot of help in an AA program called Adult Children of Alcoholics. And it was a group where people got together and talked about themselves. But it wasn't a social event. It was a opportunity to get together and perform really in-depth self-psychoanalysis and look at the personality. I'm going to talk about the meditation part today because I found in my own path that this practicing of non-doing on a daily basis affected everything else. And it really affected self-inquiry and it affected the search for truth. So, like I said, all of the people who have arrived at self-realization got there by ultimately surrendering, by letting go of the illusion of being the doer. Meditation has been called selling water by the river, and I really think that's great because. Meditation. I mean, there's a lot of talk about awakening being a sudden event, a kind of a zapping, you know, something that happens to us, and that there's nothing we can do to bring it about. This enlightenment just kind of dawns on you and whatnot. I think it's really practically it's a gradual process of disidentifying with the ego self, this imaginary doer that we think is us, and re-identifying with the absolute. So it doesn't. The ultimate disidentification, yeah, it's like when you're traveling to another city, when you actually cross the city line, well, now you're at the city. But when you started from wherever you were and you started going to the city, you were. It was a gradual process to get there, although when you got there, it seemed to be a sudden thing. So it's a step-by-step letting go of this identification with this imaginary doer, this personality, this this false self. And the process, this gradual process, is accelerated and made more deep by a daily practice. If you come to a TAT meeting once a year or twice a year, that's not as good as meditating twice a day for 15 minutes at a time, you know, every day. So if we have a regular experience of the effortless nature, the automatic, spontaneous nature of thinking, the thinking that occurs a third of a second before we realize that we thought it. If we have if we repeat that effortless realization, we get the most out of it. And it's because automatic and effortless and non-volitional thinking is the way the brain works. Everything is automatic. Like perception was mentioned earlier, that when we open our eyes, there's the world. It takes a tremendous amount of brain power to create this image of the world. But we open up our eyes, and there it is. It's totally automatic, and we don't imagine that that the eye is in there busy pulling levers and creating this image of the world. We just take it for granted. We've all experienced this automatic, non-volitional aspect of awareness a lot, but we don't realize that we're experiencing it. But just like in perception, how automatic perception is, remembering something is equally automatic. We've all had the experience of having somebody come into the room and for a moment not being able to remember their name. But if we really were, if the imaginary eye was really the rememberer of things, then we would remember whenever we wanted to remember. But quite often we have the experiences, I'm sorry, I can't remember, I can't recall it right now. And then a minute later we're busy thinking about something else entirely, and boom, that idea comes into our head and we suddenly remember, oh, Heidi. Well, where did that come from? You know, I mean, that spontaneous automatic thinking is the real thinking. We get the same thing with when we hear a joke. A woman goes to a psychiatrist and she says, "Doc, I'm here about my brother. He's really unhappy. He thinks he's a chicken. And he spends the whole day just sitting in his room clucking sadly, trying to lay eggs. He's really depressed. It's pitiful. I've tried to shake him out of it, but I just can't seem to get through to him. Can you help him?" And the psychiatrist says, "Well, sure. You know, bring him in. I'm sure we can cure him of this delusion of being a chicken." And she says, "Well, could you maybe just give him something for the depression? We could use the eggs." So what did we do to get that joke? You know, you got the joke. Did you do anything to get the joke? Or did you just get it? It was funny. Automatically, you got the joke. Well, that's the way the brain works. It really is automatic. If we could tell ourselves jokes every day, all day long, you know, maybe if we had Alzheimer's and we forgot that we had told ourselves that joke 10 minutes ago, we could have that same experience of the automatic nature of getting the joke. Well, that's what meditation does. The real remember, the real getter of jokes, and the real meditator is what we're looking for. In meditation, this is the cycle of not just effortless meditation, it's the cycle of effortless thinking, but we make use of it in meditation. We sit down to meditate and we close our eyes, and we have the meditation I use, and I think is probably the most accessible to everybody, is uses an idea that we think, but it's a very simple idea. It's a pleasant enough idea so that the mind is interested in thinking, in recalling it. But it's a meaningless thing, more like just a sound or a word. And historically, these things are called mantras. And it's not chanting. It's not It's not intellectualizing. It's sitting down with the intention of recalling the mantra effortlessly as a faint idea. And so what happens is when we sit down, we sit with the intention to think this sound. And maybe we think the sound because we've sat down to do that. So maybe the idea of the sound is with us when we sit down. But eventually we find we've gotten lost in thought and we lose track of time, and then the thoughts ease and we come up, thoughts ease up and we remember again, oh, I'm sitting here to meditate. I'm supposed to be thinking this sound. And in that, there is the faint idea of the mantra also. You know, we don't try to think the mantra clearly. We don't try to do anything. Actually, what we're practicing is non-doing. So we don't do anything when this remembering, oh, I'm sitting here to meditate, the mantra idea is there, and we just don't do anything. We get lost in thought, and then thoughts ease again, and we recall, oh, I'm supposed to be. And then we get lost in thought. And with not doing anything, this cycle just, it's automatic. This is the way the brain works. It just goes, when we have this deciding that we're going to meditate, meditation will happen. It's like when we want to think about, when we want to remember somebody's name. We can't do it, but if we back off a little bit and think about something else, then remembering that person's name continues and eventually comes to us. So what we're doing is we're making use in meditation, we're making use of the way that the mind works automatically. And we're experiencing the automatic nature of thinking repeatedly. In this meditation, ordinarily we live our lives, our awareness is kind of on the surface of the mind. We're involved in activity. This line is supposed to represent just the surface of the waves of thinking of the mind. And we're in this circle. Maybe it's actually here, you know. But in the meditation, as we relax and let go, there's a tendency for this, because we're not doing anything, we're not putting any effort into the meditation, there's a tendency for the whole thinking process to get easier and subtler and a little closer to where the thoughts originally, where they're really coming from. That third of a second gap is from where the thoughts actually start to when we become aware of them. The EEG says we made the decision down here, but the experience of making a decision occurs to us up here. So in meditation, this begins to get a little closer to the source of thought, to where the thought actually starts. In this case, it's the thought of the mantra is the one we're concerned about. All the other thoughts are incidental. They may be shopping or, you know, whatever. It's things about our life. But what we're interested in is looking for where this faint idea of the mantra, when we first pick it up, first realize it, and then not doing anything with it, but just being aware of when we recall it. And as we do that, the natural tendency is to become aware of it at a little subtler level than it was that we were aware of it the last time. We're looking for it. You know, other forms of meditation use the same principle. Sitting and looking for the beginning of a thought does the same thing. I think it's helpful to have a relatively concrete, but at the same time, very subtle thing, object, to see where it comes from. It's the same as getting a joke. If you knew there was a joke and the joke is coming, the punchline is coming, and if you were paying attention to what happens when I get the punch, when I get the joke, that's meditation too. That would be the same thing. It's just a little complicated to be having somebody. You can't have a comedian in your room telling you jokes all the time, so you can become aware of when you got it. But you can tell yourself the mantra can be your joke, and you just constantly be aware of when this thing occurs to you.